Welcome to the second part of my contributions to comparative media histories. And in this little episode, I'll be combining both propaganda with some thoughts on your presentations, with some possible advice for your presentations, coupled with showing you a few key things relating to how the church, elections, political groups, and Edward Bernays all kind of feed in to this message of propaganda. In many ways, you could actually say the best form of propaganda is the propaganda you don't notice, because it kind of insinuates itself into your experiences without your being aware that it's there. And we might talk a bit about that, because clearly when we look at some of the material that we would now quite categorically refer to as propaganda, we might sort of see it as being blatantly obvious and too biased and so on. Nevertheless, in the last few decades, it has proven to be very effective. The lecture from last week will be going up as a podcast. I just haven't had a chance to actually sort of put it up online as yet. It'll be there as a treat for reading week for you, okay? Never let it be said I don't provide you with added value and bonuses. So let's talk about this whole essence of the P word. And let's talk about how it originated and why in a week where we actually have stacks and stacks of trees giving their lives so that students can actually put posters up to say, get me elected for this particular position or whatever, we're still kind of making use of getting the message out there and how things are going. Because actually, every poster that you see put around the campus is a form of propaganda. It's a message that's being put out there for a particular reason and bias. Is anybody standing here or know anybody who is or campaigning for?
Some people, but...
Okay, anyway. But it is, it's very much a case of advertising, and you could actually say, well, where does advertising end and propaganda begin? Do they both connect over each other and kind of, is there a blurring of the boundaries? Well, as you know, I always like to start off with definitions. Definitions at least begin to start addressing some of the key areas that we come from. And as you can see there, it really goes back to the whole notion of the congregation for propagating the faith. How do you evangelize? How do you spread the word effectively? How do you convert the heathens in Latin America, in Africa, in other parts of the continents that are being explored, etc.? What's the best way forward in terms of developing that whole essence of propaganda? And that's kind of when we first start hearing the word as something which we would tend to associate with what we understand as propaganda today. Now, it's not saying that propaganda is full of untruths. It's not saying that it's effectively a particular series of truths either. It's somewhere in between. It's that grey area. It's often said that in war, the first casualty is the truth. And again, we'll see how that evolved and how the Ministry of Propaganda in Britain changed its name to the Ministry of Information. Again, subtleties of language. And that whole notion, as we said there, is something which has changed over time, it's expanded over time, and it still is. There are notions where you'd say propaganda is a good thing, and there are others where you might well say, but it's just lies, damned lies, and more damned lies or statistics. So a few quotes there to consider, together with a version of the whole notion of a gentleman who was certainly very hot on propaganda, and succeeded hugely to the extent of obviously convincing an entire nation that the way of National Socialism was the way to actually develop, even though in this particular instance, obviously, I'm using satire to actually start develop the whole system. But you can see some of the lines there, certainly the second and third quotes. Goebbels, Joseph Goebbels, the Minister of Propaganda for the National Socialist Party, and Adolf himself is looking at how propaganda is being used by all media forms. It's being used by radio, it's being used by film and newsreels, and arguably as it was beginning to emerge, that was also being used by television as well as obviously press, print, etc. In each case, making sure that a message is put forward, as Jowett says, a form of communication that furthers the intent of the propagandist. Repetition, repetition, repetition. Or the big lie. If you say something often enough, people will begin to believe it. Case in point, the £350 million that once Britain has left the EU would go straight to the health service. Total fabrication. Just as the line, we've got our country back, take back control. Simple, pithy sayings that initially think, no, that's complete bull. Everybody in this room has got a bovine stuff detector inbuilt here. We know when we're basically being fed untruths. It's something that's unique to us as individuals. However, in many cases, we switch that off, either willingly, in some instances, or because we can't be bothered. But again, that message of way things are going, the final line there. If a propaganda machine is doing its job effectively, there's no dialogue. It's one way or the highway. There's no sense of what Jürgen Habermas would say would be a public sphere, a space where people could actually communicate together on that basis. It was literally a case of one particular viewpoint focused very much on that system. And if you control the press, and you control the media, and you coordinate to that extent, then obviously the message will be out there. We talked about Julius Caesar last week. Well, you know, in our little wonderful time machine of the mind, you can see that not only was Caesar keen to actually promote his versions of propaganda, but way back in 522 BC, in terms of Babylon and so on, you see these wonderful images and packages, all of which say how wonderful Darius was. His surname wasn't the Great, neither was Alexander the Great. But you have that sort of notion in terms of how it's being used as part of this propaganda machine. So you think, whoa, fantastic, it's really good. And arguably, propaganda would have stayed in the domain of carvings and oral history and views with respect to that had it not been for a chap who basically had had several business failures in terms of producing medicine or various cures and so on, and then decided to actually hit on the whole notion of this strange, bizarre thing which he encompassed as the printing press in a room maybe slightly larger than this one, but one which enabled mass printing to be developed, so the first mass media form to encourage communication throughout society. And it was duly used to spread an anti-view of the Vatican throughout the Western world, because Martin Luther, who had protested against what he thought was the corrupt nature of the Vatican, had ensured that his concerns had not only been nailed to the door of a church, but also via printing had been spread throughout Europe. Now think about that for a moment. If you are the dominant power, i.e. state, and one person stands up, I know, let's say it's Jess, okay? She could be a rebel, I know this, you know, very much. And Jess decides to actually say something which is quite controversial. If it's just Jess, it's not really a big thing. Worst case scenario, you can execute her. Okay, shh, you know, take it out. All the rest of the bits and pieces. But if Jess actually relates to Beth and Sophie and Senna, and not only through oral history, they start producing material that is printed and mass-produced, suddenly it becomes more difficult to control. So you're into the whole essence of how do you control things. Thomas Paine, very much one of the founding fathers of the American War of Independence, together with Benjamin Franklin. We looked last week at how the Boston Tea Party was a stunt, an exercise to effectively sort of raise the awareness. If that's now developed, that then leads to the whole notion of the newspaper, as we understand it today, as very much being the heart of a mass media form. I said earlier, propaganda, a bit like a utopia, can be seen in positive and negative ways. One person's utopia is another person's dystopia. The glass could be half full, it could be half empty. And certainly had it not been for active propagandists like Wedgwood, Clarkson and so on, raising the issue of the slave trade being fundamentally wrong and fundamentally improper, that arguably we'd still have slaves today. After all, the ancient Greeks used to have slaves and didn't see any problems with it. So why should we not actually sort of manifest through that whole system? And this is, again, where you get that very important aspect, which is, again, is rooted into public relations and media things, etc., not just of slogans, and there's a very big one in terms of the head of this slide here, but there's also the whole notion of having a system whereby you can promote symbols, particularly, again, if you're looking for a broad breadth of getting your message out to as many people as possible. And obviously you can see with the symbol there, that's also echoed, am I not a man and a brother, with respect to that whole process. And you're only talking about, what, 300 years ago, less, in terms of the actual, sort of 250 years ago, in terms of where that's going. But it gets your message out there to the wider population. People can actually say, fundamentally, is wrong to kidnap people from Africa, ship them over to America, get them working as slaves there, etc. Now, admittedly, there are always two or three sides. You could say, yeah, what about the African chiefs who actually sold their people into slavery? Yeah, it's okay, fine, it's still wrong. So you still have issues relating to how that's developed and so on. And that, again, proceeded with respect to, obviously, the advent of photography, the whole notion of how this is developing from that point of view. You can see that Haltenham there talks about the pornography of pain, this sort of notion of shocking images. It is a form of propaganda. Now, it can be used, again, in two ways. You can use it to effectively sort of raise people's concerns, saying this must never happen again. Or you can start saying, well, how is this being caused, etc. And we'll show you in a few moments how, again, it can be twisted as well. And how actually being able to discern what is appropriate from what isn't appropriate is really essential to how that's being used sensitively and so on. Again, it's interesting in terms of the line that Stamp talked about there in 1980. Abolitionists never argued that the physical treatment of slaves had any decisive bearing on the issue of the morality of slavery, but at the same time, if you see images of fellow human beings with huge whip marks on their backs and various other bits and pieces, you might, if you're human, hopefully, and have a certain amount of empathy, say, actually, this is unacceptable in a society that calls itself, quote-unquote, civilised. How does that roll out? That gets the same image, but we see this being developed and rolled out. It's a classic example of how you can use propaganda to promote a message which is positive. The early movement for the emancipation of women and the suffragettes kind of went through similar sort of areas, using all kinds of ways to develop and raise the profile, etc. Because it kind of begins to form that substance of what we would say would be the formula for propaganda. A story plus mass media. That's what kind of people relate into and how things actually go from that basis. Okay, so when did the Ministry of Propaganda effectively launch in Britain? Well, strange enough, it was with Kitchener's poster and a whole variety of other things, which is also echoing Uncle Sam in the United States. Now, what do those posters tell you, apart from the fact that traditionally we're kind of so used to them, even though none of us in this room were alive when they were first sort of being echoed in terms of our mass culture? It's pointing directly at the viewer. It's also tapping into the whole notion of, in the case of Britons, God save the king, join your country's army, to patriotism. It's feeding into that whole notion. If you have the opportunity to see Peter Jackson's film, They Shall Not Grow Old, it's really worthwhile watching the first 25 to 30 minutes. I mean, the whole thing is really good. It's only 90 minutes in general. But it shows you, it tells you how effectively 16-year-olds would sign up, even though technically you shouldn't sign up until you're 19, but they were persuaded, they were kind of encouraged to do so, because if they were seen as basically sort of not joining up, then they'd get a white feather from their girlfriends, there'd be all sorts of, they'd be classified as cowards, and so on and so forth. So it's really tapping into that collective shaming, if you like, you know, group shaming. So you actually then say, oh yes, we'll join you from that point of view. And if you're obviously on the other side of the Atlantic, if you're going for Uncle Sam, you know, the essence. I mean, Uncle Sam is a fictional character. There never was an Uncle Sam. It kind of emerged as an election aspect in the late 19th century, post-Civil War, when actually they take the challenge in America, where you'd actually just had a country that was split apart, or obviously over the issue of the emancipation of slaves, and clearly Lincoln had been assassinated as a result of that. So there was a need to kind of get some kind of national unity. So this figure of Uncle Sam was kind of created as a symbol of American decency, American democracy, and so on. We'll see that echoed in some of the comic issues and graphic narratives we'll look at in a few moments. But this is where we come back to that whole notion that said that in war, the first casualty is the truth. And there we have some of the sort of people who were involved with the first British War Propaganda Review. So, H.G. Wells, what did he write?
War of the Worlds.
Yes, and The Time Machine, and The Invisible Man, and The Island of Dr. Moreau, and Things to Come. He wrote stacks of stuff, did Herbert George Wells. He was influenced by Darwin, Survival of the Fittest. He was influenced by a whole range of other folk. Rudyard Kipling. What did he write?
Jungle Book,
yes. If, he was a poet. A whole range of things. Arthur Conan Doyle?
Sherlock Holmes
and?
And The Lost World.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, again, prolific writer. Prolific believer in spiritualism as well. Thomas Hardy, also. A key writer. All writers of fiction. Why were they hired? It's the equivalent to these days putting together, I suppose, J.K. Rowling, together with various other writers and so on, possibly Anne Leckie and others, to start producing things which will promote the government's point of view. Remember that equation, narrative plus media equals propaganda, that way in which you actually work through that. And again, they were all designed to promote the government's point of view. I mean, if you think about the First World War, it has its roots in so many areas, including the assassination of Archduke Ferdinand in Croatia and a whole stack of other Serbia. No real message in terms of why we went to war, etc. But they still developed the whole notion of how do you get this message across to get people actively involved with this whole thing. And Beaverbrook, of course, who was the press baron in charge of the Daily Express, also became the Minister of Information. Actually, there is a type of that, should be 1918. I've just realised, not 1818, so I should change that. So Beaverbrook, in running the Daily Express, was quite blatant, as indeed Rupert Murdoch, or quite blatant today, or indeed other sort of folk. He was seeing his newspaper as nothing more than a propaganda vehicle which would actually enable him to move into government and so on. And you can see from that quote that was actually there that, you know, that was clearly what he was going for. The more popular circulation, the more people knew the name, the more people knew he was actually there, then the higher in society he would actually climb. It's populism carried through that, you know, the very popular vote, etc., capturing that whole system through that double whammy of high circulations and advertising and so on. As I say, look at Silvio Berlusconi in Italy. Look at Rupert Murdoch with News International. Look at Jeff Bezos with Amazon and the Washington Post. Look at any media owner that's actually there. Raises their profile, develops a whole range of other things. Sergey Brin with respect to Facebook. Okay, so this is First World War material. Again, you can see quite categorically it's actually there. Let's look at the left-hand side first. Anybody like to sort of decode that particular package with the line, children actually asking their father, whilst the little boy is playing with his toy soldiers, Daddy, what did you underlined in capital letters, doing the Great War. Remember, the Great War is what we're referring to, the First World War aspect. What is that tugging at?
Guilt.
Absolutely.
It's like the fourth elements, the coward thing.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like, what did you do in the Great
War?
It's making it's like playing on.
Here is the head of the household, the patriarchal head of the household. He's got his two children, sort of there from that point of view, and he's having to think, what did he actually do? If you're in that position, can you face your children and turn around and say, actually, I was a conscientious objector? Difficult. Middle one, much more blatant. Really hits you between the eyes, doesn't it, really? You've got the classic militarism helmet, which is very much Germanic in origin. You've clearly got the maiden that's obviously blonde and white, who's being, who knows what's going to happen to her? It's the classic Beauty and the Beast, even worse than that. And of course you've got the bloodied club with culture written on there, Kultur. And clearly you've got that beast, that terrifying beast, the gorilla, the ape that's so much sort of seen in a whole range of aspects. And the big message, in case you haven't got it, destroy this mad brute, enlist. Likewise, slight return to this, committee of alleged German outrages. And again, you can look at weapons of mass destruction in this century and Tony Blair and his views on the whole aspect. Report of the committee on the alleged German outrages by Her Majesty's government. If you wanted to put that into mass, nobody's going to read that. People might start paying attention to that. This one, it hits you right between the eyes. The message for each of them is pulling together these three aspects. Guilt, fear of the unknown, and of course anger. Use time and time again. If those of you with me with reporting continuity and change, when we talked about moral panics back in the first year, aspects within that still kind of tapping into those areas. And as I say, it's a two-way process. Here we have a situation whereby you have cartoons being used with after the assassination of Edith Cavell, Nurse Edith Cavell, a great movie actually with Deborah Kerr, a genuine character. The assassination of this innocent nurse who was deemed to be a spy. Then we actually have the Daily Mirror, this 1915 edition, giant Cunarder crowded with passengers, callously sunk without warning off the Irish coast. Dial back to this year and Donald Tusk daring to say there's a cold circle of hell waiting for people who came in with Brexit without a plan for what to do. We were obviously shocked, because we don't do that in Britain. We don't have headlines which says, up yours, Delors, and you're a rats. No, don't do that at all. It's a sad sort of reflection that maybe you need to use a biblical line, take the mote out of your own eye before you take the stone out of somebody else's, or vice versa. But again, messages that come across there. And so it goes on. I mean, there's stacks and stacks of these things. Jane has actually done a whole series of exhibitions relating to this, which ties into the whole experiences of, again, these two characters are very much known through the war as basically being the Kaiser Bill and the sort of little Bill from that point of view. I mean, it wasn't so much a Hitler aspect, because Hitler was actually just one of the troops in the First World War. Obviously wanted to be an artist, but then he was turned down on that and took into a whole different aspect. But again, messages coming through on that basis in terms of the next to be kicked out, and of course the notion here, actually, I don't know if you can actually see that, but you see, what are the pigs all wearing? On their heads.
German helmets.
German helmets. What are they actually eating? An innocent maiden, there's the blood there. Again, you don't have to be an English literature scholar to appreciate the message that's being put across in this way. And that's the other aspect about propaganda. It's often highly simplistic. It has to be, really, if you think about it, because it's not looking at a kind of refined, almost academic, university-educated populace. It's aiming at mass communication. That's the whole essence of getting the message across there. So, I suppose I could have said the Americans, but what the heck. This is at the time where clearly, as I mentioned last week, Edward Bernays in particular was keen to actually look at how you could use various media forms, be they newsreels, be they print, or be they again the emerging radio, to actually support government policies. And all of this ties into the whole notion of providing speeches to actually ensure that censorship is adopted so you don't get the press actually providing different viewpoints. They're actively encouraged not to, maybe through indirect methods, such as if sponsors are threatening to withdraw their support for a particular newspaper, then maybe you need to actually choose what things you're going to promote, etc. But you'll still get your kind of message, you'll be on message and promoting it from that point of view onwards. And there are a couple of links here which actually start talking about how film in particular, which really started, as I say, at the start of the 20th century, and then first feature films started rolling out by, I mean, Birth of the Nation, D.W. Griffiths, hugely racist now, it was remade a few years ago. But again, if you want to watch it on YouTube, you can take the whole thing from that perspective. And I mentioned, obviously, the Peter Jackson colourised version of They Shall Not Grow Old. Visual images, moving images, can also have huge impacts in terms of how people actually see themselves and their country as well. Okay, so the Great War is over. We won. Yay! I don't know what we won, but we did win, 1918, or at least we had an armistice. So what happens in the years between 1918 and 1938? Well, huge growth of radio and film in particular. And as Edward Bernays talks about there, he is very much of the belief, almost an evangelist, for the new social sciences. He's looking at how you can actually start using this technology to influence people for good or ill. You know, as we said last week, we talked afterwards in the Q&A about how Bernays was also responsible for promoting tobacco, cigarette smoking, as a means of actually calming your nerves. Massive success there. A lot of cancers as a result, but he'd already long gone by then. So again, lots of other challenges coming through in terms of that essence of seeing propaganda being a good thing, almost becoming institutionalised, that it's a way of actually getting a message, a way actually almost back to the notion of the Catholic Church originally, of propagating the faith being obviously the secular faith of the country that you're working within, and so on. Similar time though, of course, you're seeing the growth of National Socialism, who also have a message that they want to put together. They also want to start putting out lines and views that impact in terms of how people see their activities and so on. And Goebbels and Leni Riefenstahl, very, very successful propagandists and filmmakers who really succeeded in tapping into this whole notion of looking for heroes, developing those sort of systems. And you can see in the second point there why that was a really significant state move to make. If you have to register, if you're a creator in any of those fields, then that basically means that whether you're working in radio, television, film, press, you effectively have to, if you want to get paid, you've got to register. And if you register, clearly you are already beholden to the government, the state, the propagandists, to actually get your message out from that point of view as well. Of course, the irony being that actually we taught the Germans most of their propagandist techniques. We, of course, being Britain, because we'd already done it with respect to the success of the recruitment mechanisms in the First World War. God damn it, they've done it again. They've taken our best routines and now they've turned it back on ourselves. Again, don't get it caught up in the nationalism, but do think about the kind of human aspects of that in terms of how things are going and developed. The Soviet Union, which had had its own revolution after the Great War and executed their royal family and so on, were also very much aware of the impact of propaganda. And Lenin's quote there, which is often much beloved of filmmakers, etc. is often added to by his consideration that if Russia, the Soviet Union, I should say, controlled Hollywood, they would conquer the world within a few days, basically. We've seen very much that conquered again from that point of view. Because, again, as James actually said, it manipulates things. It manipulates the emotions, it manipulates the feelings, and so on and so forth. As hopefully we'll see in this little excerpt. Obviously, you can watch the entire thing on YouTube if you wish. But the very symbolism of coming down from the clouds, the heavens, the Valkyries, the whole notion of this nation beaten, battered, depressed, they had huge inflation and so on, being rebuilt, restructured, going on to become a leader amongst... You know, it's got to tap into your patriotism and so on. You know, it's actually developing that whole essence of national unity, a whole sense of siege mentality, you could actually say. Everybody in Europe was against us, and here this one man, Adolf Hitler, Ein Volk, Ein Land, Ein Führer. One folk, one country, one leader. Simplistic messages constantly hammered home, where, again, admittedly, lots of people might have actually said, this is ridiculous, this is hopeless, etc. But again, you're also seeing the whole way in which strategically you're taking up people who don't agree with your particular viewpoint, and you're using techniques of propaganda to really echo that whole thing through the process, etc. The marching troops, the marching bands, and of course the phenomenally deep patriotic music that's actually there as well. It's addressing all sorts of things. And now, of course, a friendly crowd, the people looking for the Führer, and so on and so forth. You know, I've got to say, hats off to Leni Riefenstahl, fantastic documentarian. You know, she's captured so many key things within this whole field. I don't know any science fiction fans here, if you've ever seen the series Man in the High Castle, anybody? Yeah? See, I mean, the take on that is basically what would have happened if, in an alternate dimension, Germany had won the Second World War, but they still sort of echo this whole notion in terms of where things are going. And here we are. I just think, if only he'd been given clearance to do his artistic things, he wouldn't have actually had this Heil Hitler and so on and so forth. Anyway, you've got 1 hour 44 minutes if you want to actually sort of watch that in full. And actually, it's probably... just to get a sense of sort of the way forward and how things were developing, it does give you an interesting insight into how it was being used there and how it was turned back in on itself as well from that point of view. Anyway, we are here. Hollywood, as I mentioned, big player in terms of propaganda. Same sort of aspect. Look, even Walt Disney's actually getting into the whole sort of system from that point of view. And Chaplin very much promoted The Great Dictator as a complete spoof on the Nazi enterprise, etc. Casa, this is all before America actually entered the Second World War. Remember, America didn't actually enter on behalf of the Allies until 1942 due to a mixture of certainly the Pearl Harbor attack in Hawaii by the Japanese and also the whole notion of gradually sort of getting messages saying, look, you know, our cousins in Europe are actually suffering as a result of this, whatever their faith, religions, etc. and so on. And again, keeping the simplistic form going, you've got a variety of other things, whether it's Dr. Seuss's cartoon there in Russia, a chap, so we're told, and it's an object strange to behold, asked what is his gag, he says, this is the bag that the great Adolf will hold. It's clearly referring to Joseph Stalin, who in that time was obviously a friend of the Allies, and of course his battle against Hitler and so on, after having of course signed a pact to actually work well together. Politicians, as I said, always tell when they're lying because their lips move. Anyway, that's just by the by. Let's have a look at another sort of excerpt from the point of view of a more aspect which comes across here from the Ducktators.
Barnyard some years ago, a seemingly unimportant event occurred which was destined to vitally affect the future of that little world. Mr. and Mrs. Duck were expecting. Aspirations dreamed of brush and palette, but ended up with only the brush. His artistic efforts spurned, he soon turned to other endeavors.
Und vergiss nicht, du Dops, ich bin der abgeblasene Fresh in Deutschland, in all Europa, ja in der ganzen Welt. My mother told me, say hi.
And there were some gullible ones who listened. Especially one goose, more gullible than gooses. Geese usually go.
That's all right. That's all your stuff, big kiddo. He's a smarter fellow with brains, huh? Like me.
I'm a sick pilot too. peace from off this place. Have they forgot 'tis love that's right, and naught is gained by show of might?
Cliffhanger ending is obviously Benito Mussolini, Adolf Hitler, and the Japanese folk are actually all interconnected from that point of view. But you're certainly seeing again this way in which messages are being put out there. Now, on the one hand, you say, well, actually, Disney probably called it right in so many ways, including apologising to the very nice ducks and geese that are actually in the audience. But you're still combining all of this in mass media forms with a range of aspects within this whole field. Is there much difference, pound for pound, between what we saw in the First World War and this poster, for instance? Apart from the fact that they don't have any children as yet that we know of. Or indeed the whole aspect that you're seeing here in terms of the title that we see on that sort of basis. You know, Liberators from that perspective. And of course the actual images that are used from that point of view in terms of we've got so many sort of details and bombs throwing at you and we're building up all sorts of other aspects too. And of course, where would Stan Lee's career have actually been had he not got together with Jack Kirby and Joe Simon and a variety of other things to produce the beginnings of what we now see as the whole new master race of the Marvel Expanded Universe and the DC Expanded Universe and so on. Only a few weeks before Captain Marvel launches. Many people are criticising it on the basis of it's not good for single white males. Nick Fury doesn't come up for a call at all from that point of view. But again, it's another issue. Again, you can see here in Batman, to go with Superman, of course, entertainment, yes, and some might say, actually, entertainment is the best way to subtly inculcate propagandist messages into the whole world. Because actually, who wants to be bored by a whole series of politicians just droning on and on and on? Isn't it a lot better if you can actually get a much more subtle message put across? And as the original Captain Marvel there, or Shazam, as he'll be known in his movie incarnation, also sort of says, let's talk about various ways forward. Submariner hasn't quite evolved as yet. I suppose Aquaman was the equivalent from DC. Submariner was very much sort of Marvel package from that point of view. Again, things to think about in terms of how things are being developed and so on. And radio, in addition to that, adds to this whole range of how mass propaganda is developed. William Joyce being the voice of Germany. He was eventually executed for treason at the end of the war, but he was very much constantly on the airwaves saying how Britain was doomed, we might as well give up now. It was hopeless on that basis. We mentioned H.G. Wells, no relation, of course, to Orson Welles, but in a classic example of how mass media can influence people, the night that panicked America, as it's referred to, in 1938, when the Wells Mercury Radio Company effectively put together a real-life dramatisation of the invasion by the United States by Martians, panicked folk to such an extent that caused huge panics across the east coast of America, and so on. Franklin D. Roosevelt's Fireside Chats, the notion of a president of the United States talking one-on-one with his people. Again, one of the strengths about radio, or indeed podcasts as we know them today, is it basically doesn't need to be a group of folk. You can literally have that direct connection. You can reinforce prejudices. You can possibly use it to educate, enlighten, elucidate, and so on. Or you can also complement it, as Adolf actually used, to get this sense of mass rallies. It's interesting, again, that if you look at it from an analytical point of view, Churchill was far better on radio than he was in newsreels, and vice versa for Hitler in many ways. You know, it was that kind of experience of the huge rallies that were developed, which offset his somewhat manic tone and exasperated line and so on and so forth. So, gone through the Second World War, gone through the Great War, what do we actually do in the 20th century in the last few years? Well, again, in the 1950s, The Reds Under the Bed, the whole range of movies like the Invasion of the Body Snatchers, This Island Earth, and so on, all tying into this fear of the Reds. McCarthy, of course, the McCarthy witch hunts, and the Hollywood House Un-American Activities Committee, where people were encouraged to denounce any of their fellow actors that they felt had any left-wing, socialist-leaning tendencies, because of, again, the fear that somehow the Soviet Union, the communists, would eventually take over America, burn the flag, and have all sorts of problems. It's as bad as worrying about Mexicans coming over with all their drugs and things over the border and completely infesting the entire country. Better build a wall, really. The whole notion of Rocky wrapped in the American flag, the wonderful sort of triumphalism that comes through from that point of view. And, of course, that thing which you're never quite sure, you know, do the Americans support the Irish rebels when they were looking for a united Ireland and the Irish Republican Army, or was it a case of no, they were developing various other sort of aspects? But certainly you've also got the notion of before the fall of the Berlin Wall in the 1950s, 60s and 70s, the CIA, when they weren't installing dictators in Vietnam and indeed other countries, they would fund German-based radio stations to promote their propaganda and so on. Same thing with anti-terrorism posters. Same thing, actually, in terms of the propaganda that's used by groups like ISIS these days to actually get other messages across and so on. And that's where we are now. OMG! Lies, damned lies, fake news, fake news. Roll back and scroll back to where we came in terms of the messages that's coming through, and maybe you won't see too many differences between what we've been talking about and where things are going on. Again, just some of the things to consider from the 21st century there, in terms of how we're being told consistently that elections are being manipulated, that votes are being changed, that extremism comes through, and so on and so forth, etc. Maybe you need to engage your inner bovine stuff detector to actually discern what is appropriate and what isn't appropriate. Thanks for your time. That's okay from that.